Welcome to the OFR Farm Report, your look at the Atlanta Braves minor league system, brought to you by OutfieldFlyRule.com, hosted by Andy Harris and Matt Kritzberg.
Hey folks, this is Andy Harris, and with me is my partner, Matt Kritzberg. Matt, happy opening day.
We're finally there. We got a drag creek kicking and screaming, but we're going to make it.
Stumbling and bumbling, and just today, Juan Soto came up with a positive COVID-19, and who knows how many Nationals have it, but we are here. And today was the day that all the major league teams had to turn in their rosters. I've been tracking this for the Outfield Fly Rule site on a page that called Making the Squad. Oh, for I think 5 years now, I've been tracking this opening day roster, or it sure seems like it. Here they are, finally an opening day roster. We'll talk briefly about that. Matt, any surprises to you on it?
Not really. I mean, especially considering the roster moves of the past few days, getting Julis Chacin back in the fold. I think the one minor surprise, and we've seen it coming here for a few days, was getting Tyler Matzek in there. Congratulations to him making it all the way back to MLB after several years of being out. But that's a great thing for him, and hopefully he'll get some nice situations to be put into early and have some success.
Yeah, that's actually a pretty cool story. I'll probably put something up on the website about Tyler Matzek here within the next 24 hours or so. But yeah, it was pretty much what is expected. I guess maybe the one thing that's a little surprising is that of all the great farm system the Braves have right now, only one rookie made the opening day roster, and that is Kyle Wright, who looks like he will be, at least for now, penciled into the fifth starter spot for Atlanta and starting on Tuesday against the Rays.
And if Cole Hamels hadn't been hurt, that number would probably be zero.
Yeah, that's a great point. Or if Felix Hernandez hadn't opted out.
Yep. I mean, the possibility, I mean, his stuff was just too good in spring training 1.0 and 2.0. I think at the very least, he might have been a piggyback option. But the way it looks right now, you got your five starters, and it looks like Chacin, Tomlin, and Tukey might be kind of your long guys. I'll just kind of rotate in and out, and then you'll have your eight guys in the bullpen behind them.
Right, at least for the first 2 weeks. And then, you know, the intrigue doesn't end there. In 2 weeks, they'll have to shorten the roster down to 28, and then 2 weeks after that, down to the normal 26. So there's still going to be some tough decisions coming up here. I thought the last-minute signing of Julis Chacin was interesting. He hasn't really relieved much in his career, but it seems like they're going to be using him as a long reliever here. We, of course, know him from his brief experience with Atlanta, but he actually has had some good years in between. He was the opening day starter for the Milwaukee Brewers just last year, 2019. So kind of a big drop. He didn't have a great year last year, but I'm guessing that they've seen something with him that they think they can revitalize him as a bullpen option.
Yeah, I saw a stat out there that his fastball may have been one of the worst in the major leagues last season. So they may just kind of go do the Anibal Sanchez plan and just kind of basically drop his fastball, throw a lot of slower and off-speed stuff. And maybe if they bring him in as a piggyback option to one of the left-handers like Fried or Newcomb, where the lineups are already going to be stacked with right-handers, that maybe that'll give him a chance of success. And if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. I mean, you can always jettison him here in the couple weeks if things don't seem to be working out, but there's going to be some definite chances to dump him if the opportunity should arise.
Absolutely. And, you know, this was a similar thing last year with Josh Tomlin, right? He was basically a failed starter with Cleveland. You know, he had his moments, but, you know, the year before he was really bad. So, but, you know, there were some things that the analytics guys in the Braves front office thought they could make something out of. And Tomlin turned out to be a fairly reliable reliever for all year, which, you know, you can't say about most of the Braves relievers last year.
And it does help that Tomlin really embraced the role, and he seems to enjoy the kind of being the utility guy of the bullpen. It's like if they need to pitch an inning here or a spot start there, it seems to kind of fit his wheelhouse pretty well.
Of course, Chacin's signing meant pretty much the end of the chances for some of the young guys to at least make the opening day roster. Now, we totally expect these guys to be filtered in and out as needed, as you know, I mean, pretty much like previous years where they were constantly bringing fresh arms up and then rotating them out. I think that'll be especially heightened, if anything, with the short schedule that we'll see these young guys brought in. And that's specifically Patrick Weigel, Tucker Davidson, Wes Garyanoa, and Bryce Wilson. All of them, I thought, did pretty well in the spring training 1.0 and in the intra-squad games that were televised mostly on YouTube. Tucker Davidson especially, I thought, was sharp. I was a little surprised that Matzik made it instead of Davidson, but I fully expect Davidson to play a big role this year.
Yeah, and of course, this year the story is going to be depth. All these guys are pretty much going to get a shot at some point if you're on the 40-man roster or in the or even in the 60-player pool. And of course, part of this too is as of the time of this recording, they have not announced the possible 3-man taxi squad as of yet. One of the three players on the taxi squad has to be a catcher, so I'm guessing that's going to be Alex Jackson, and then there'll be a couple other spots. So some combination of Weigel, Tucker Davidson, somebody else might be included on that taxi squad as well. But I'm also thinking that at least in one case, they'll keep somebody really stretched out down at the player pool in case they're, say, one of these starters gets hurt or unfortunately get a positive COVID test, that they can bring them up on a moment's notice and be ready to throw 5 or 6 innings.
Yeah, if I had to guess right now, I would say that it's probably going to be Yanoa and Davidson in the taxi squad, a lefty and a righty, and then keep Wilson and Weigel kind of stretched out. But we'll see.
Yep.
Speaking of the two catchers, I thought both Jackson and Contreras looked really good in the intra-squad games. I thought at the kind of the beginning when spring training 2.0 was starting up that the Braves might look at getting a third veteran catcher that they could put on the taxi squad and put in there for emergency. But they're obviously feeling pretty good about both of those guys. To be able to, that either one would be able to step in case something happened to Travis d'Arnaud or Tyler Flowers.
Of course, obviously, Jackson would be the first choice, especially for short term. But let's say if one of the other catchers gets hurt and it looks to be a long term type situation, I don't know if they would be hesitant to bring Contreras up at this point to fill in for a longer term type situation.
Yeah, his bat looked especially good. He's really quieted his hands a little bit. He used to, before the pitch was thrown, really rock those hands, which when you turn, kind of rock his head a little bit. It's much quieter now before the pitch, and I think that really helps him out, kind of keep his head on the ball and drive through the pitch. Saw him; he's always been good at hitting through all fields, but he's really doing that now with more authority. And then Alex Jackson, we've talked about his evolution behind the plate. He really has kind of become, and I saw a coach mention this the other day. I forget which one it was, but you know, basically call Alex Jackson almost an elite defensive catcher at this point, which is wild when you consider kind of where he started when he joined the organization.
And when you consider the state of the lineup this year, where you have a designated hitter in here, if it came to that, you could plant him towards the bottom of a lineup that's got a DH in it, and just for his glove. And whoever thought that when they traded for him that we'd be considering defensive specialist Alex Jackson?
No. All right. So moving on. By the time this podcast comes out on the website, that would be outfieldflyrule.com. Our new top 30 prospect list will be out. This is what normally would be our mid-season update. Of course, it's not mid-season. It's the beginning of the season because everything is crazy. So we don't call it the mid-season update, but it's something that we put out about this time every year. And it's just to kind of update, give our thoughts on the top prospects in the Braves organization. It's top 30 instead of top 50, which is, top 50 we do in November. But And of course, this year was nuts because there's been no minor league season, of course. So there's actually very little data for which to make evaluations at this point. I know I wasn't sure if we would ever going to put one out this year, but I feel like there are still a couple of data points that are relevant and probably worth reevaluating what we put out in November. And that is basically age. There are just prospects that are going to weather the storm of not having a minor league season better than others. And that's awful. It's not fair, but it's just the reality of the situation. And then we'll talk about likely changes to the affiliate program a little bit later in the show, but that's all going to weigh into things too. There's going to be a lot more pressure, especially in the lower minors, for guys that are kind of stuck there because they didn't have a chance to kind of show out and prove they deserve to move up. So kind of the main things with the list, I know you've seen it. I put it together. I did the write-ups. The write-ups are pretty abbreviated. There's not a whole lot of extra things to say that we didn't say in November. Probably the major theme of the list is that the younger players that joined the organization in 2019 and that 2019 draft, they all generally moved up. They have time to develop still. They have a lot of talent too. So it's not just all age based, but that's the kind of the impetus for their moving up through the prospect list.
Yeah, and it's going to be real interesting to see where they pop up next season, especially the ones that are able to get work in the player pool, like Michael Harris and Vaughn Grissom, that it might enable them to skip a level this season or start well beyond where we thought they would going forward. But this 2019 draft is shaping up to be a monster draft, not just based off the quantity of players they got that are in the organization, but the quality of the players they're going to get as well.
Yeah, and then you throw in kind of the younger players from the previous drafts, and there's even some younger college players that I think all are going to weather this a little bit better. Bryce Ball, for example, is even though he was drafted out of college, he's on the younger side. Same thing with Casey Kalik, and then of course Victor Vodnik from 2 years ago was drafted out of high school, still a relatively young man. So they all basically move up just based on the fact that they've got a little bit more time to develop. The guys that got hit the hardest are guys more into their mid-20s and have not gotten into the upper levels of the minor league system.
And people that really needed this, you're like A.J. Graffinino, Raleigh Delgado, and then C.J. Alexander after his injury issues last season. They're the guys that really are going to be hurt by what's happened to the minor league season this year.
Yeah, C.J. Alexander was 22 for us in November. He's not in the top 30 now. A.J. Graffinino was 29, not in the top 30. Logan Brown was 30, and not in the top 30 now. These guys haven't done anything wrong. It's just the nature of just where they are in the organization and how things shook out. And it's a shame, but that's just the way we see it right now. Trey Harris is another guy. I still love Cousin Trey, but unfortunately he really dropped in the list. Same thing with Grayson Genesta. They're still in the top 30, but they're not quite in the lofty spots that they were before. We also had to put in the 2020 draftees. There were three that made the top 30. The highest, of course, was the first round pick, Jared Schuster, who is going to debut at number 11 for us. And then Bryce Elder, the number 5 pick, comes in at 21. And then Jesse Franklin, the outfielder from Michigan, comes in at 24. Obviously, these are educated guesses because we haven't seen them play in a professional setting, and we probably won't until maybe Instructional League or Arizona Fall League or something. It is nice that Jared Schuster is with the at the alternate training site and will be working out with the team there. So I'm hoping that the Braves will maybe televise some of their games, and we will get a chance to look at least at some of the prospects that are over in the camp.
And that's not an unheard of possibility, because I believe it was the Phillies that announced today that they are going to be televising their alternate training site games on local television. So hopefully the Braves can do something similar and maybe put them on YouTube or something. I mean, there's some avenues out there to get it done.
I think they were probably surprised when they threw a couple cameras up on YouTube and they had thousands of people checking out their intra-squad games at Truist Field. I mean, there's a hunger for that kind of information. So hopefully the Braves will adopt that.
I'd be fully on board.
Oh, yeah. Anything else you want to discuss about the prospect list?
No, I think that's a good thing. Just when it comes out, they should be, this podcast and that list should be hitting almost simultaneously. So get out there, read it. We can always talk about it.
All right. So the last thing we want to talk about is there was a couple of articles in Baseball America that came out this week, both from J.J. Cooper, who really is the journalist that's out there right now that's most following the goings on between Major League Baseball and Minor League Baseball. Of course, they're in a very ugly and protracted negotiation over the professional services agreement. That is basically the contract between MLB and Minor League Baseball that establishes the affiliate system. Since 1990, that's been renewed every 2 years without a lot of fuss and fight. This year, MLB is on an aggressive campaign to really remake the minor leagues. So this week, Cooper came out with two articles. The first was a real eye-opener. It entailed kind of, for the first time, MLB's strategy, of which this negotiation is really just a part of. It's an overarching strategy for Major League Baseball to be, and I'll quote him here, to become the coordinating decision maker and guiding force for baseball and softball at almost all levels. Now, when I talk about all levels, I'm talking Little League, I'm talking showcase tours, I'm talking wood bat summer leagues, I'm talking independent leagues, I'm talking college baseball, and of course, minor league baseball. And they have strengthened their relationship with a lot of the other organizations that run these leagues. And now they are really making a push to basically run minor league baseball.
Oh, yeah. They're trying to bring everybody in to make the umbrella a lot bigger and bring all these different factions underneath it, while at the same time passing along some of the development costs to college baseball with eliminating some of the lowest levels of the minor leagues. But like I said, like the RBI program was mentioned, the inner city baseball program. But it's going to be a top to bottom kind of thing. And if they can kind of get this all coordinated and organize it well, it could be a positive thing for baseball. But the way MLB is being run these days, I'll take a wait and see attitude with that one.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because when I was reading this, is like, I wish they had articulated this to the public beforehand. I don't know why they're being so secretive with this, because it's really an impressive, you know, strategic plan, and one that I think is mostly positive, like you said. But when they started negotiations with this minor leagues, it was very much a, we're going to do this. We're going to cut the affiliates down to 120 from 168. You're going to like it. And the reason for this is because facilities are bad, which is an argument that didn't make sense on the face of it, because the rules that govern facilities were in the professional baseball agreements, which MLB was a party to. So if they had a problem with facilities, they could have addressed this with minor league baseball at any point. They didn't need to wait for negotiation. So it looks like that whole thing was just basically a canard to put a public face on this antagonistic attitude. You talk about how baseball is run. if they had just come out and say, hey, we have a new vision and we want minor league to be the minor leagues to be part of it, and this is how we want it to go, I think they it would have been a much better rollout of this whole thing.
Yeah, and PR has not been MLB's strong suit as of late or any time in recent memory, but that it's another just black mark on the way they handle things. And as we see, as we talk about whenever we get to talk about the next piece that J.J. Cooper wrote, there's some out-of-the-box thinking going on these days, and hopefully that same out-of-the-box thinking will to apply to this One Baseball initiative as well.
Yeah, so let's talk about that because, we're mostly focused on minor leagues. So the second article that came out was mostly about how these changes to the minor leagues, the way that's envisioned right now, and it is intriguing. Probably the thing that was the most eye-opening is the idea, and I don't know how much this has backing of MLB, but it seemed like it was a strong thing they're pushing for, but basically flip-flopping the high A and low A league classification. So the Florida State League, the California League, and the Carolina League, all the current high A leagues would become low A leagues. And then the current low A leagues, which would be the South Atlantic, Midwest, and Northwest leagues, would flip to high A. That would allow, first of all, the low A teams to be much closer to the league complex sites, especially for the Florida State leagues, but also the California League, which would cut down on a lot of travel for players that are promoted and demoted to and from. And it would, and obviously there would be some teams that would, move and go from one league to another as part of this to kind of rationalize everything. My first thought, of course, thinking about the Braves is I can see this as potentially saving the Danville franchise. I could 100% see Danville becoming a member of a low A league.
It's almost, it's almost like a piggyback type situation where they talked about, and we'll dig into this more here in a bit, but where teams would conceivably be in one location for the first half of the season and a different location for the second half of the season, but it actually making sense, unlike some things we've heard lately, like the Tampa Rays talking about possibly, okay, we'll spend the first half of the season in Tampa and the second in Montreal for no apparent reason. But this is actually, if they pull it off, makes sense. But kind of going back for a second there, if they swap the leagues like it was, let's just say who knows what's going to happen with the Florida Fire Frogs, but if that same scenario was playing out where the Florida Fire Frogs would be moved down to low A, if somebody was promoted from the GCL to low A, it's the same place. You literally do not have to move.
Yeah, I'm assuming the Florida Fire Frogs are not going to be a going concern after September. No. but the example still stands. If that happened today, you are absolutely right. It would be, simply just moving lockers, right? For a Braves prospect to go from the GCL to low A Florida. And what he was talking about, the possibility of teams actually moving midseason, it was the idea. And I think this is a pretty interesting idea. And you mentioned out of the box thinking. I think this is pretty much the example of it. So the Florida State League is a relatively low performing league as far as attendance. And it's especially true in the second half of the season as, Florida weather with the daily thunderstorms come in, ridiculously humid and hot. What if the teams only played the first half of every season in Florida and then moved to the north for the second half and played in these stadiums that are currently occupied by the New York Penn League, which is a league that under the new rules would no longer have short season leagues anymore. So they would all keep their affiliates, but they would just be the second half home of essentially the Florida State League or whatever it would call themselves. I don't know how that would work logistically, and it may not, but I like the way that is thinking. Somebody is really putting some thought into this, and I don't know. I think that's pretty nifty idea.
Yeah, because version 1.0 of this plan that we heard all along was that, okay, we'll just keep low A through AAA and we'll just lop off everything below low A. And that was the end of it. But if this version of it goes through, that gets to be, of course, a little more complicated, but it would save baseball in a lot more communities than the first version of the plan was going to do.
Right. And there was also mention about what would happen with the Appalachian League. Obviously, if you take the short season leagues out, the Appalachian League would essentially end as far as being affiliates. Basically, the idea right now is that most of the teams that are in the Appalachian League would convert into basically a Woodbat college showcase league, where I think especially for college seniors that don't get drafted with the with what will be a shortened draft. Instead, if they don't get drafted, they would basically sign up with this the new Appalachian League. It would still be loosely affiliated with MLB, although the teams themselves would not be affiliates. And teams could pull from that perhaps to fill out rosters if spots open up, or if a player, a college senior, really started showing out and scouts started liking them. And I don't know about that. I think there's some potential there, but MLB, at least for now, has said that they will guarantee that every town that currently has a team will still have some sort of team afterwards. Now, obviously, going from affiliated to non-affiliated is really going to probably lessen the interest in those towns. But I don't know. That sounds somewhat interesting. I know I travel to make sure I catch Danville every year. I certainly wouldn't travel to go catch a college senior circuit game.
And it also depends on when the draft's going to be. If the draft's still in June, it's kind of all bets are off with this plan. But if they move it to the off season, like every other sport does, have it at a different time of year, once the College World Series is up, get the seniors who are people trying to showcase themselves, send them to a short season Woodbat League like the Appalachian League. And if timing wise, it don't want to fit perfectly for a short season league.
Right. So the last thing I saw was that, first of all, in coordination with this, the college baseball season itself might actually move to, I believe, a March through July season. And then the draft would be either at the end of July or early August. And then anybody drafted would simply go to the complexes. The folks that want to continue playing baseball but weren't drafted can then either go to the Appalachian League or can sign with one of the independent leagues. And these independent leagues would also have a sort of agreement with MLB baseball to help facilitate movement for players to and from the independent leagues as necessary. So I don't know. I mean, there's some positive things about all this. And I think a lot of this, most people could probably get behind. I wish MLB would lay their cards on the table. And like I said, I think the feeling behind this would certainly be a lot more positive if they weren't so secretive about everything.
Yeah, I'm kind of taking it with a grain of salt for now, but I want to kind of see more about this plan. But based off of MLB's attitude and PR about it of late, I'm not going to accept it on face value. They may just be using this as a negotiating ploy for all we know. But if this does come to pass, I think it would be a lot better version plan. It may not be as good as what was already out there, but it would definitely take a lot of the sting out of losing dozens of teams all at once.
Absolutely. All right, Matt. Well, that's all I had to talk about today. You got anything else?
No, I think that's a solid ending there.
All right. Well, looking forward to tomorrow's opening day tilt between the Atlanta Braves and the New York Mets. And win or lose, boy, it sure was good getting baseball back. Even those two exhibition games as the Marlins was was filled a hole that I didn't even really feel at the time that was there. But just getting those guys back and playing baseball really felt good. So go Braves, and we'll talk to you all later.
Have a good one.
No. Ni le bien qu'on m'a fait, ni le mal, tout ça m'est bien égal. Non, rien de rien. Non, je ne regrette rien. C'est payé. J'ai allumé le feu, mes chagrins, mes plaisirs, je n'ai plus besoin d'eux. Balayer les amours avec leur trémolo, balayer pour toujours, je repars à zéro. Rien, ni le bien qu'on m'a fait, ni le mal, tout ça m'est bien égal. Non, rien de rien, non, je ne regrette rien, car ma vie.